Welcome to the Failing Writers Podcast. Made from broken hopes and dreams, glued together with the tears of stark, unforgiving self-realization.
Do you remember such a thing as the tracking on your old VHS?
On the VHS
recorder?
Yeah.
Every bloody time we'd get a film out, and the tracking would be off. And I'd be lying on the floor, twiddling the tracking knob. And my mum would be like, right, that's it. Stay like that. It's like, I haven't touched it. Well, when you put your arm in the air, it was fine. All right, I'll stay here with my arm in the air then.
It was always a tiny, tiny little dial knob, wasn't it?
You can't nudge that thing very hard.
You could barely, like, get into alter it.
Kids today won't understand that, will they?
But you get that wonderful bit, wouldn't you, the start of VHS tapes, where the sound would go a bit wallopy as well. So you get, like, a really, like... as the start of a film.
I love the starts of films.
Sometimes I will just watch the first 10 seconds of the film. You know, when you get all the... I don't know if it's because you're excited about being at the cinema, but it was, you know, when you get like the made-up pretend production companies that they have for each film. I wonder, is that... That must be someone... There must be in LA or something. There must be a full-time creative
logo maker.
Literally.
Just comes up just, with little logos.
Comes up with your company name, sets you up your dodgy offshore account for your... one-off Hollywood accounting
And a little animation with a bit of music.
And you get an animation, you get a quirky name and an animation.
Yeah.
And I like to think they do so many and that they're so big now that you don't get to choose. It doesn't matter whether you're Steven Spielberg or anything. You come in and go, oh, I need a... Do you need someone, do you? Yeah, I need a company and a name. Right, you have got...
Moonbrass.
Yeah, exactly. It's just like, oh, I'm not sure. That's what you've got. Here's your animation. Fuck off. You've got... Yeah, it's like a polar bear playing on a VW Beetle. What? Look, that's what we've got. That's what we've done. So that's what you're having. Beetle Bear. It's called Beetle Bear. Deal with
it. When I was at uni, one of the guys in my sort of final year project group, when we made our final year film, he was obsessed with the idea that he was going to have his own production company. And he spent a fortune, a student fortune, but a fortune on getting someone to animate a little logo for him. And this was in like 1999 or something like that.
Yeah, but he's a multimillionaire now. He runs that company in LA that forces people to... he does them all. Spielberg, everyone. Christopher Nolan. Yeah.
It's called Armageddon Films or something like that. And his thing was like this asteroid coming in and sweeping around the Earth and then destroying it. And it was really quite wanky. We had this idea that we could, if we'd have been any good at animation at the time, was to somehow superimpose his face onto the asteroid so it looked like his face was destroying the Earth.
I can see it now. And was it good? Did you actually... So this was actually animated. Did it look good?
It was the best part of the film. Let's put it that way.
I see. Okay. That was where all the budget went, literally.
Yeah, the rest of it.
That's what I'm saying. That generally is the best part of the film. You get those little sonic triggers. You get the thing. And you might, if you're lucky, there's a lot of companies involved, and you might get three in a row before. And then after that, you still get the main production house as well. So you still get a Warner Brothers or whatever, or 21st Century Fox, whatever it is.
I like the Dolby one. You know, they're just as...
That is nice.
Oh, I love all that stuff.
Yeah, and if you watch a series for long enough,
you know that
you put them all together in your head as well.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? One just sort of flows into the next one.
So we should get one of those for the podcast. Or like two.
We should do a little animated logo thing.
Animated stuff on audio. It's really cheap to make as well because you don't actually need to have anything.
Yeah, that's
tell
true.
What it is. It's a polar bear on a VW Beetle. Everyone sees it. Everyone knows.
Yeah. So I was going to ask, what have you written this week? But I'm feeling less hopeful than usual. Is that fair? Has anyone written anything?
No. Nothing. Not even a sniff.
I've been doing some background character development for sort of a novel idea that I've got.
Have you? Have you?
Yeah, I have actually. It's fleshing out quite well, quite scary.
Is this the one that you didn't want to tell us about before?
Oh, bollocks. Yeah, shit. Bollocks. Yeah, no. No, nothing this week, really. Just dead quiet. Dead quiet. Nothing. Shit, I forgot about that. Oh, yeah.
Come on, tell us a little bit.
I can't tell you anything, because as soon as I tell you, then it'll be a thing and then I won't do it.
Just a little.
I need the element of surprise. I need to feel smart. At some point I go, oh, by the way, lads, I finished this novel.
All right, give us the name of one of the characters that you've been fleshing out.
I haven't given him names yet.
You don't want Birdie to come.
I watched something that had a character called Bobby Brown in it the other day, and I meant to write down what it was. I genuinely did.
You've been eating chips, haven't you? Before you're going to bed again. Is that what it is?
No. Swear to God. I need to try and work out what I watched last week. There was definitely a Bobby Brown.
Because it's such a good idea, dear, for a name. That's why.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a great idea.
I mean, that's why me and John discouraged you. Not because we thought it was silly. Just thought it's so good. Someone's probably done that.
If I could choose, I'd be called Bobby Brown.
So that's what I've been doing. John, what have you been doing? I assume, again, you asked the question, so yeah, you've obviously done something.
I've been chipping away quietly on my murder mystery. But yeah, slow going. But I'm doing me 500 a day. Just keep
good.
Yeah, exactly.
So you're still moving forward,
that's
though. You're not going back.
Going in the right direction, just very slowly.
You're writing forward.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. So we can't talk about that book then, Tommy. But what we can talk about is a book that you have written. And I was going to ask you, how are you actually feeling at the moment, Tommy, about this? Because just for the listeners who don't know what we're doing this week, we're going to give our unfettered and frankly uninvited analysis of Tommy's pastiche sales Bible, which is... How long have you had that finished? You've had that finished for about a year.
It's been finished for a year, yeah.
Finished
it's
for a year.
Work in progress.
But on the boil for,
a decade,
for like 10 years or something?
Yeah, pretty much, give or take. It was kind of a book of two halves. Yeah, I kind of wrote half of it and then did nothing and then had a bit of... With the podcast was the kind of... The leading up to the idea of the podcast was the burst to get it finished. And then it's just sat wallowing in its own comedy treacle for the last year.
Yeah.
But it would be nice. It'd be nice to try and push forward some stuff, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
It'd be great to
do something.
That's sort of the plan of this, is to focus on our projects and try and help each other to kind of progress them and maybe actually even get them over the line, get them out there into the wild where people can actually look at them.
And you asked me how do I feel about exposing myself to you two gentlemen, if I may use that phrase. It's probably an apt time to play the silly little ditty that I made.
Ooh.
So John and Dave are going to have a read of me book. They said they'd help out and have a cheeky little look. How nice of them to share their totally valid observations. I'm sure I'll take them all on board without any reservations. Thing is, though, I couldn't give a shit. I don't care. Whatever their opinions they see fit to share. You know what? I couldn't give a flying fuck-a-doodle-doo whether it's good or bad news. But what harm can it do? They can have a look, can't they? It'll be fine, I mean. It's not like they're going to rip it to shreds, is it? What if John says that chapter 4 just doesn't really work? Or Dave says he's struggling with the narrative and I end up looking like a Reitberg? Or John says badly written in places and Dave says worse in others for my money? And then they both agree that it's all very silly and not in the slightest bit funny. Oh no, what if I give a shit? What if I care? I hope they bloody like it. If not, I'll despair. Do you know what? I'll just delete it. File it under B for bin. It'll never see the light of day again. Hold on. Does that mean that I care? Oh, dear. Well, I guess we'll find out, won't we? I mean, I'm going to pretend I'm not bothered either way, whatever they say. I wrote this book for me, not for anyone else, so why should I care? And anyway, who minds a little bit of constructive criticism? I'm a grown-up. I can take it. My ego can take it. Probably, I think. Yeah, just play it cool, Tommy. Just play it cool.
So yeah, I'm not really bothered what you say.
It's a lovely ditty.
It took us on a journey, a very honest journey, I think, in terms of the thought process of swinging from, I don't care what they think. I mean, obviously, I hope they like it.
All I would say is that that ditty is probably longer than the amount of notes that I've got to give you about the book.
How much of it have you read, Birdie?
I have read every single word. I've read the whole thing. And that is a first for this podcast, ladies and gentlemen. That's the first time that I've actually finished reading a book that we were going to be talking about for the show.
We're going to talk about in the podcast. Apologies to all our previous interviewees.
I'm quite honest about it. But I have finished the entire book. I couldn't say that I've made a load of notes. they're all in my head.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's
the way good. That keeps it fresh, doesn't it? Yeah. Keeps it nice and fresh.
But going back to what you said just before that about it, you know, we're trying to get people to do something with what they've done. That would be my very first note, is that this book, Tom, deserves to be read by as many people as possible.
By more than two.
By more than two people. Because I loved it. I thought it was, just to give the whole review away, I thought it was really, really good. I thought it was really, really funny. It made me laugh a lot. I think, yeah, anyone, particularly anyone who's ever worked in sales or knows somebody who's worked in sales,
yeah,
it would make a lovely, what was the phrase? A lovely little stocking filler type present.
Yeah, backhanded compliments, Chris Bailey. Yeah, very much a lovely little kind of stocking filler present.
Exactly.
But there's loads of delicious mind nuggets in there.
Trademarked.
In fact, actually, that's a good point. There is one little anecdote in there that I think I might recognise.
Let me just give the lawyers a quick call before we discuss anything much further, Dave. Which bit would that be?
There's a little bit about lemonade in there. Lemonade and beer.
Oh, the lemonade top.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I'm pretty sure I told you that story.
I don't know if you did. No, I didn't. I got that from, that was an old joke of a colleague.
Was it Dave Baird?
A radio colleague. No, it was...
radio colleague.
If you ever came across Paul Hollins, lovely guy, presenter, and he was full of little cheeky japes, and that was one of his. So, you order a pint of lager at the bar, go, hey, you're right, love. Is there enough room for a spot of lemonade in that for a lager top? Yeah, of course there is. Put some fucking lager in it then. Was his little... Exactly, it's funny, isn't it? No, Dave, what's your story?
That was exactly that. I'm trying to remember where I heard it now. I'm thinking, hang on, know it because... Or did I get it from you? Have you told it to me before? And then I've thought I must have known that from somewhere else. And told Tom back. Oh, how these things go round. What a minefield. But yeah, no, I thought it was, I'm not going to get too effusive in my praise, but I thought it was really, really funny.
Thank you.
Really, really sort of well thought out. And it's broken down into proper chapters.
It did actually structure up well. And I have to say, I did show it to John years ago. A little bit of his advice on that was that it was good and funny, but it didn't seem to have a direction. So I tried to order it in terms of getting a job, first day at the job, but like kind of there's some structure of eventually becoming the boss. So it is a little bit of a timeline, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh my God, so you've actually taken some of my feedback.
Yeah. Thanks to John Rand for that advice.
But it reads like a proper, you know, sales self-help book would be. The way it's sort of structured like that, it's... It is reminiscent of a lot of sales books.
I mean, to be fair, it is a huge, huge pool to fish in, isn't it? The kind of the satire on that kind of book. Because there's so many of these self-help books that seem to have a good core idea and then somehow have 200 pages.
Yeah, just sort of repeated, say that in a different way.
Did you have a flick through some sales Bible type things? Or this was, I'm guessing you probably don't really need to because it's all the same kind of jargon. Yeah. It's a sort of self-help jargon.
I've been forced to read some in the past.
So you have actually, you have some experience.
We've all been forced to sit through the live seminars and things, haven't we, at various times?
Yeah. So many of them are based around one core thing that's just like absolutely flogged to death. But you've got to do that to make a book that's going to look big enough for someone to buy, haven't you? I remember seeing one, like a TED talk, and this woman, now a multimillionaire, been on Oprah Winfrey and everything and what have you, because she'd written this book about stopping procrastinating. And her thing about stopping procrastinating was to do the thing that you procrastinate.
So her cure for procrastinating was just to get on with something.
Was to do whatever I think it was like count to five or count to ten or something.
How do you get
I mean, that's quite a hard book to pad, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
But she's a multimillionaire, does talks and everything, motivational speakers. Her basic concept was if there's stuff you're putting off, don't put it off.
You say that. But we've made about 40-something episodes of this podcast pretty much saying that message, haven't we? stop procrastinating and get on with writing. And we've made hours and hours out of it. So before I pass over to John, who I'm sure has got much more comprehensive notes to go through, I've got a feeling John's probably going to put his glasses on in a minute so that he can properly read the notes out.
Yeah, he's going to put his glasses on. He's going to waft his hair away from his face so he can see and go, right. And do you know what then he's going to do? Just before that, going to pause and just move his glasses down his nose a little bit.
Yeah, look over the rims and say, right, chapter one.
Let's break this down.
Well, no, the only thing, if I had to be critical, and I don't...
No, we've finished
it. I'm going to anyway, is every now and then there are what come across as jokes in it.
Yeah.
And that might seem like a ridiculous thing to say in a comedy book, but what I mean is this: every now and then it sounds like a Tom joke rather than something that Chad Nadworthy would say.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like every now and then, like you say something and then you just embellish it with a little joke and you go, that's funny. That is really funny, but that doesn't sound like Chad Nadworthy said it. It sounds like, you know, Tom's thought of an extra funny line and put it on there.
Couldn't resist.
Yeah, yeah. And I just think like if a little pass just to take a couple of little bits out and make sure everything is in the same sort of voice, you know, gives it that bit of extra.
That is good feedback, that. That is actually quite good. Oh, do you know what as well? I forgot to play this. Made a feedback ditty.
It's feedback time. It's feedback time. It's feedback time.
Get ready, Tom.
Here's some feedback we're getting you to see that you're sometimes gonna need that cheeky little wee slap.
On your bottom.
You sat there with your silly little book with all its witticisms. Look, we're gonna hit you with them.
Constructive criticisms.
You don't have to take them. Recommendations. But if you don't, it might be a mistake. And then you'll awaken in a situation where you're sad because you probably should have taken on board some of the feedback that was given to you in good faith.
Yeah, and maybe your project would have gone on to win awards. And you might be sat talking to Jonathan Ross now instead of watching that new comedy drama series on Netflix whilst criticising it.
Turning to your wife and pointing at the screen and saying, I could write better than that. Yeah, that's rubbish. That is rubbish.
Nice.
Double ditties.
Double ditties this week. It's feedback time.
It is feedback time.
Yeah, I would...
Feedback,
I mean,
John.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, coming off the back of that, I mean, it is a book. It is rich with funnies, isn't it? It's, and in the best bits, sometimes there are even like jokes within jokes, and you have to sort of stack them up on top of each other in your brain. And
is that a good thing?
It's extremely pleasurable.
Do you mean cleverly written jokes or do you mean convoluted writing?
No, it's incredibly pleasurable. It's like an overload. It's really good. It's extremely well honed. It does feel like something that you've written over a long period and you've gone back to and
sort of titivated
because it's some of it is incredibly well honed. And
you sound like you're going to say well hung every single time you say that.
Well, it's so well hung. It is. It's well hung. With gags.
Like a piece of beef that's been hung and is now tasty.
It's very
yeah, it's aged really well. Yeah. And it's gone like slightly...
A bit crispy around the outside, but the inside is really...
Yeah, succulent. The only downside to like stacking it with so much goodness is that I think you've probably made life quite difficult for yourself in that there are a couple of bits that probably just need a bit more work in order to get them up to the standard of the rest of it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, that's the problem of making it a lot of it very funny, is that the bits aren't quite as good. They do pop out a bit.
Yeah.
But there aren't very many of them, to be fair, you know. And they tend to be at the back end, you know. I think you can tell that the stuff that you wrote later on hasn't had quite as much work on it, maybe.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Is that fair?
Yeah, yeah.
Because I was doing a little bit of proofreading for you as well. I thought I'm reading it anyway. I might as well like check for typos and stuff. And there were a lot more towards the end.
Did you get a red pen out?
Yeah, I did. I did the glasses thing and I got my red pen out. But I really love it. Yeah. Do you want some bits that grabbed me?
Yeah, don't give too much away.
I want to read a couple of bits because I think they're really nice.
Should we have explained earlier? People know what this book is, don't they?
That is a really good point. We explained it last week.
If you haven't, it's your own stupid fault for not. It's your own stupid fault for not listening to more of our episodes.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah. But if you've got to this point,
for those people that may have listened but then forgotten, this is basically a pastiche of a self-help sales training book pitched as the 2-hour sales Bible, which can be read by a salesperson in 2 hours to hone their sales technique. And it's created by Chad Nadworthy, who thinks he's the best salesperson ever to walk the earth. but he's actually a bit of an arse.
Is that the log line?
Even though all of his anecdotes as well basically end in failure.
But he's completely oblivious to that failure.
Yeah.
Or he sees it as the rest of the world's fault and it's just not his.
Yeah.
Just bounces off him. Everything just bounces off
but
him.
Yeah, I was just gonna give a couple of little bits without giving like too much away or anything. But they're just
It would actually be really interesting to hear. What bits you found particularly funny?
Yeah, I mean some of the
because I gave it to my wife to read as well, and I was literally sat watching her read it, and every time she laughed, I said, "Right, what are you laughing at? What are you laughing at? Which bit are you laughing at now? What are you laughing at?" And she was laughing at some of the stuff that I was thinking, "Well, I nearly got rid of that because I didn't think it was very funny."
It's almost as if comedy is subjective, isn't it?
Get out of here, Dave. What kind of comments that to make?
That can't be right. But then it wouldn't fit into the rules that we've been learning.
That's true as well.
Yes, it doesn't work.
So there are nice little moments of brutal truth, like when Chad sums up who you need to be in order to be a great salesperson, whilst also inventing a word like any good sales guru should. The quote is, basically, if I only had enough space to write it on a gravestone in a fortune cookie or on the wall of the toilets at the bowling alley, the message would be, don't be yourself, you're probably a dick. Be the salesperson they want on their team, driven, ruthless, and literally shitting enigmagneticism. Enigmagneticism. Then there are moments where you're sort of simultaneously quite highbrow and quite lowbrow at the same time.
Yes, I like that about Chad. I like that he can just get off.
Yeah.
He thinks he's been so, like, reaching up so far above his education.
Yeah.
And it's just like, a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. He's kind of, yeah.
Yeah. Now, bearing in mind that I estimate probably 12 to 13 million people will be reading this book, possibly more if it really takes off, which, when you consider the quality of the content I'm providing here, that's a pretty likely scenario. Then you'll need to come up with your own made-up content for your CV. But my secret would be to think big. If you're going to tell a lie, tell a big one. Can't remember who famously said that, but whoever it was, that dude had the right idea, yeah? And there's that, you get that little hit of pleasure when you know that he's quoting Goebbels, but he doesn't. And I thought that was a little stroke of genius. It was very nice. And I like his mad rambling bits as well. Like when he sort of briefly comes completely off a point, just to talk about himself.
Just to flesh out his ego or to feather his own nest, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah. You've heard the phrase, the customer is always right. Yeah, well, I came up with that. I mean, I think someone had come up with it before me, but I still came up with it after. I'm like a zillion percent sure that I'd never heard it before. But even if I had, which I hadn't, I'd definitely still have come up with it.
Yeah.
That's lovely.
Very nice. Lovely.
And then finally, I just wanted to read this little bit. This is there are like slightly weird meta bits. There's bits where there's this particular bit where you're talking about spending a lot of time in the early 90s making deals in saunas. And there's this really strange bit where you start conversing with the reader and with the editor of the book simultaneously. And it's just so stupid and weird, but it is brilliant. And it goes like this. I spent a great deal of time naked and sweaty with clients. Remind me later to tell you my top tip for concealing about your person a pen at all times, regardless of your state of undress. Oh no, hold on. You can't remind me, can you? This is a book, not a conversation. Although my fluid and award-winning writing, note to editor, insert the awards I win for writing this book in the second edition, etc., probably makes it feel that way. So, if you're that bothered, write my agent a letter to ask, I guess. Unless you're reading this in a sauna, which I assume a great many of you are, in which case you'll either want to know how to conceal a pen about your naked person and therefore won't have one to hand to write a letter, or you will have one with you, but that means you've no need for my idea about hiding a pen vertically between your buttocks. On second thoughts, note to editor, should we get rid of all of that last bit? Up to you. You're the one who's going to read this from cover to cover and make sure it's all cool before sending it to print. Right?
Nice.
With comedy spelling mistakes on sending to print there.
Yeah.
The bit that I wanted to sort of mention, I don't really want to mention because it kind of gives it away. But the whole premise of the chapter about my time behind bars really tickled me. But if I say why, it gives it away, so I won't say.
People will just have to buy the book.
Just have to buy the book, which means you just have to sell the book, Tom.
Oh, shit. Yeah, that's... yeah. God, everyone's bloody double-edged in this podcast, isn't it? It really is.
It's a poison chalice.
Thanks for all the praise, boys. That means I can't put it in the bin.
You can't put it in the bin.
No, definitely don't put it in the bin.
Shitting
buggers.
It would be a tragedy and a, and a crime against humanity, you could say.
There's such beautiful bits in it. It is so good.
Yeah.
But there is a however. Do you want the however bit? In MasterChef, I think the music changes here, doesn't it?
Does it go into like a minor key? Or just a deep sustained?
Yeah, it's like a drone comes in.
However, and then someone chops something and then the music goes into a beat again.
And then Greg Wallace goes, it's too sweet even for me. And I love sweet things. I'd eat a bag of sugar. If you poured a bag of sugar on a wet baby, I would eat the baby. But this for me, it's just too sweet.
And also, he does that weird thing. I recently noticed it. He's got a really odd smile.
It's his lips. Yeah, he's like got very...
Because he stays really still, and then like the sides of his mouth start to slowly pull back and reveal his teeth, and he's just stuck in a very awkward looking. Weird. Yeah. Anyway,
he's like a live action of Wallace and Gromit, isn't he? Sometimes
Wallace of Gromit.
Wallace of Gromit,
the famous knight.
Yeah. Oh, I think we've just done a job for Aardman Animations for the next. I could see that. Wallace of Gromit. Yeah, yeah.
Starring Greg.
Go on, John, what's your bad news?
Oh, yeah, however.
we've talked about this before, and I think it's related to the fact that you started writing this a long time ago. Mm. But the style of it seems placed in a moment in time a little bit. Like, it feels like something that was written a little while ago, in the sense that I think probably when you started writing it, there were more people who were actually like that. Do you know what I mean? Or it was more okay to be like that. We've met some of them. But I think there might be a really easy way to potentially deal with that, is that maybe you could make the book look like it was printed in the 90s.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? Place it back in its original context and sort of make fun of that era a little bit. The era in which we actually, you know, did our sales training. But I think you could have a lot of fun with that as well. I think you could dot it with quite bad clip art and stuff, and get, you know, a bit of Comic Sans on your cover design or something. I don't know, but it sort of feels like it needs to be placed in a bit of a context. I don't know. Well, yeah, I think it's just because
I think those people still exist.
Yeah, yeah. I think if you just go to Curry's at the weekend and try and buy a kettle,
yeah,
you'd be surprised.
Yeah.
Or try and go and buy a car from some car dealers, it exists.
Maybe you're right.
Really,
I think people are just a bit more, maybe just a bit more careful. Because
I think you may be out of the game a bit. I think might be.
Yeah,
the,
yeah.
Well, yeah, that's probably true. I still buy things off people.
There was a really interesting part of Will Storr's interview where he said about that experiment they do with like psychology students. So at the start of it, they interview them about their bias, and then at the end of it, they do the same thing once they've done bias training. And they've all learned about other people's biases, but are completely oblivious to the fact that they still have the same biases. And I think that's how it is. I think a lot of people are like, will say things like, oh, the world has changed and you can't say this and you can't say that anymore. But they still do and say those exactly the things that they complain you can't say anymore. So, I think
just complain. Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's definitely still a place for it.
And I think you're probably right what you're saying as well, John. But I think maybe there's a way of making it so it is just Chad Nadworthy being out of his depth and out of time.
Yeah.
So he's telling these old stories.
I think it's because it's so hugely over the top. You know, it's sort of it's sort of in that viz.
Yeah, yeah, it's
bit,
got to be,
isn't it? Do you know what I mean? It's not
subtle.
I don't know. I was sort of thinking, like, and you'll totally hate this, but I was thinking you could do a version of this that was like, I don't know, keeping it a bit more subtle. I mean, a lot of it actually is. All my favourite bits, I think, are actually quite subtle. So you keep all the posturing and the wankery, but you place it a bit more into the subtext of the writing, if you know what I mean. So you do his over-the-topness, but you do it through sort of humble bragging and virtue signalling and all that kind of stuff. But you still have, you can still have all the stupid, pointless, wanky things like the acronyms and stuff, and the fact that the guy can't see how bad they are. I don't know. It just, I suppose, I mean, again, it's probably that subjective thing. Yeah. The stuff that I really enjoy is the sort of the just slightly more subtle play.
You like feeling smart about yourself, don't you? Do you know what I mean? That's what you
yeah,
you
exactly.
don't like people giving you stuff on a plate. You're like, oh, I've worked that out. I bet some of the other people reading this, bearing in mind there's only Dave and my wife that have read it, I bet they haven't thought of it. Oh, I must text Dave and see if he understands. On page 37, Dave, do you get it? Do you get it?
Did you get that? But did you get it on this level?
Oh, you only understood it on that level, did you? No, I think, yeah, it's different.
But you know what I mean? There's a lot of big, there's a lot of big action in there. There's a lot of, you know, well, I don't want to say it because I don't want to give it away. But
I am probably going to ignore that feedback.
Yeah.
I love the big silly as much as anything in it. But yeah.
But it was great.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to read it, guys.
It's only 2 hours.
Pleasure. I really appreciate
Total
it.
Total pleasure.
And I read the last chapter just before we came on. But it still did read the entire
fresh
thing.
In your mind,
exactly.
Isn't it? That's what you want.
Exactly.
Fresh in your mind.
Yes.
G'day, I'm Jason Donovan, and when I'm not belting out various pop music classics such as Too Many Broken Hearts, Especially For You, and Don't Put Your Finger Up My Bum Just Yet, Thanks, I like listening to the Failing Writers Podcast.
Question that's been floating around ever since we started the podcast. Have I taken enough of the massively offensive stuff out? Does that sit about right?
Looking at what was...
Dave, I'm not bothered what you think, Dave, because you'd be like, yeah, no, that's fine, whatever.
Looking at what was in there, compared to what I know you're like, then I would say, yeah, you've taken quite a lot out.
That's probably a very fair comment.
Yeah, well, I read the other version, so I know that he's taken quite a lot out. No, I think it's about right. I mean, it does get outrageous at times, but it's all right. It's not like...
It's not wrong.
No.
And it's that thing as well. It's him as
it's
well.
It's the
isn't
character.
It?
It's
him
yeah, it's the character.
Yeah, it
Roll
is.
Your eyes at him.
That lets you get away with anything, doesn't
just
it?
Well,
it does, but I think... Yeah. No, I think it treads the line, but it doesn't fall in to whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's
but
good.
It leads me on to the next point that I was going to talk about.
Sorry, but you've got more points.
Yeah, I've got more points. I want to talk about next stages, Tommy.
Right. We'll do that in a couple of podcast time or something.
Yeah.
Or like a year next season.
I've signed us up to Readsy. Have you heard of Readsy? I thought I might have mentioned it the other day.
When you say signed us up, you've signed our podcast email up to it and you signed my personal email up to it, didn't you?
No, I didn't sign your personal email.
I think you did.
I've been getting emails about Readsy as well. I just wondered what that was for.
I've been getting a lot of emails from
I think you, they're just coming through Failing Writers. Oh,
right, okay. Sorry, I may have unsubscribed then because I got annoyed at how many emails were.
But basically, it's an online portal that helps authors find publishing professionals like editors and designers, proofreaders, you know, everything, publicists, whatever. And I thought that might actually be useful. And the more I think about it, Tommy, and the more I've been reading about self-publishing, I think the more apparent it is that authors really do need editors. You need someone objective, more objective than Dave and I, who's going to say, this bit needs to go. I'd rewrite this bit. I love that concept. That needs a bit of a shake-up, whatever. And I don't think Dave and I can do that. And so I think you do need someone who understands the business, do you know what I mean, of putting books out there. And they will be able to tell you, okay, that is too outrageous. You can't say that. Because I don't think we really, I think we've got a good idea of what offends us. But an editor would have a good idea of what potentially might upset other people.
Yeah, well, yeah.
I think that should be your next step.
Saying, and I get that's all received wisdom. But I don't know if I could trust someone to do that.
Well, you can still ignore them because you're paying them.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah, I think that's the point, isn't it? I think that's right.
Yeah. I to pay someone to ignore me.
But it gives you something to think about.
I don't think Tom would take very well. I don't think Tom would take very well to an external editor saying, well, I don't think you should do that. But still, I do think it would be a good exercise. As John says, you can roundly ignore everything they say, but it would be good to have that objective outside opinion
that
you can then completely ignore.
I think they'd just make it better, to be honest. I think they'd have a
I think
good...
that's typical naive John Rand thinking. It really is. It really is.
Because ultimately, if there is a joke that you really, really love and they say, you know, get rid of it. Just keep it. It's
yeah,
fine.
No, absolutely. I just, I think it's
a bigger
so
picture
that.
Thing, Tom, rather than a.
Yeah, it's not
like,
so much.
I don't like that joke. I don't like that one.
I wonder about finding someone that gets it.
Well, there is that, but that's part of the. That's what Reedsy does as well, is to help you find the right person.
The right person, yeah. I could definitely see it. I guess I hold out very little hope of finding the right person. I guess that's more the.
No,
point.
I definitely think it would be worth it.
Okay, so there's one thing. I also think. You have to spend quite a lot of money here, Tom. I also think you need an outrageously good designer who can help you put it all together and make it look like a sort of authentic sales manual. Ideally, like an old one that's looks like it's sat on a shelf for 20 years. I think that would be brilliant.
I think you also perhaps need some diagrams.
Exactly, stupid diagrams.
And I really think. Exactly. Because all books have those little few pages in the middle with just some pictures that aren't necessarily related to anything that's gone on.
Oh, yeah.
Just some pictures that are mostly like his holiday snaps
that'd be good,
or, a picture of that, the fake plant pot and the coffee
Chad
cup.
Chad with Sir Alan or whatever.
Things like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. But I know you're sort of naturally reticent about these things, Tom.
Oh, massively, yeah.
And you sort of think, oh, I don't want anyone else poking their nose in. But you genuinely should do something with it. You genuinely should. It absolutely deserves to be read. And that is going to involve, as horrific as this might sound, that is going to involve somebody that you don't know reading it.
Yeah.
Which is... ultimately, what writing is all about, isn't it?
If you choose it to be that, yeah, of course it is. It doesn't have to be that, does it?
Well, that doesn't. No, but then we've just wasted the last year.
Yeah, very much.
And 40-odd episodes of this podcast.
But at least we've come to the realisation it is all pointless and you don't actually need to finish it.
The
it's
end.
It's taken us this long to figure it out.
Finally, in one step, they become... the failed writers.
But we got some nice ditties out of it, didn't we?
So,
we can all listen to the music.
No, you've got to put it out there, Tom. It's too upsetting to think this just sat there.
Do you know what? We did this with John, although he has thus far ignored it. We did say if 10 people asked John to do his tree story.
I remember that day.
I remember it very well that he would do it. I mean, he's failed to do that, but. I think people out there should now send in their formal requests for Tom to release this book.
Yeah, I don't think we need to do that.
And if 10 people say they want to read it.
I'm definitely on board with moving it forward.
Yes.
I'll have a look into.
So let's talk deadlines. So here's what I'm thinking, Tom. Text should be finished and edited by October.
All right, I'm going for this. Yeah, cool. That seems
that's,
like yeah.
that's
right
a
now.
Good. That's a really good
yeah,
deadline.
Yeah, yeah. Mid October.
Yeah.
In fact, no, let's go early October. Oh, okay. Early October. October, let's go for an arbitrary day. 6th of October. 6th of October. And we're hitting the shelves start of November for the old Christmas present market.
Oh, okay, right.
And I think that gives you a nice incentive to aim for a deadline.
Yeah.
Hang on. Wait a minute. Mm. Wait, so finish writing the book. By this early October and have it on the shelves in November.
Yeah.
You seem to have missed a few stages out of this process there.
Nah, that's all done. It's done. Now, we need a design result. It needs to be designed, of course. And that, what should we give him for full design?
I don't know. Your timeline, you've lost me with this process here.
I clearly
don't
really understand how long it takes for books to be sorted, do I?
No, hang on. If you're saying, just focus on the words until the beginning of October, then we'll get a designer and an editor and a proofreader.
Oh, no, the designer needs to work on it before the text is finished. I'm just saying you need to. But the way it works these days is that you basically, you print on demand, don't you?
Yeah.
So you don't send your books off to be printed. You'd have to wait for them to be printed.
But then they're not going to be on a shelf.
It's not a literal shelf, Dave.
You said
it's
shelf, John. You said the word shelf.
Okay. Well, there'll be one on Tom's shelf and there'll be one on our shelf.
Well, I've already read it, but, I don't need to read it. Maybe I'll get one from the library.
I don't want to read it again.
I liked it, but not that much.
Yeah, but it'll have new stuff in it. It'll have clip art and diagrams in.
That's true.
It'll be cool. Yeah, so we also need to talk, Tom. Are you feeling up for that? Getting it out for Christmas?
I don't know. It depends what you say next, to be honest, John.
Okay. Well, I think we need to talk. I think if you are up for it, we need to talk about the consequences of non-compliance. And I was thinking, I've got an American friend who wanted to lose a bit of weight. And not being a very big fan of Donald Trump, he vowed to give $200 to Trump's previous campaign fund if he didn't achieve his goal. And it had the desired effect of, you know, motivated him to meet his target.
Right.
So I was thinking, you should sign the legal decree I'm forwarding you now, Tom.
Can I just check this has been properly looked at by a team of crack lawyers?
You'll be able to see straight away that it's all properly, formally legal.
Could we say that it's above board? Because I think that's it's the proper legal phrase, isn't it?
I've had my guys look at it, so yeah.
Should we put this on the blog so that our listeners can double check?
Oh yeah, no, everyone should. Yeah, everyone should have a look. I think.
Yep. Okay. I mean, it looks legit, I have to say.
Is it on? Mm-hmm. Is it on headed paper?
It is. Yeah, I'm quite formal. Headed paper. So this is from the very official legal document. So official, the Queen has signed it herself.
Yeah, I did actually get the Queen to sign it. Thought that would make it.
I, Thomas Langoustine Turner, do hereby formally and legally commit myself to seeking an editor to help me craft my book into a bestseller. I can't guarantee that, John. Already legal language is quite shaky there, isn't it?
Well,
I can't commit to making it a bestseller.
I think you can, Tom. I think you can.
I can't commit to it being a bestseller. You're going to have to. I can try and make it a bestseller. I shall also go promptly forthwith, even with a little spring in my... Steady on, son. What's this?
It's legal stuff.
This contract will not stand up in court, John. It's asking unreasonable measures. You can't... Contract law doesn't supersede existing law. Everyone knows that. Spring in my step. To procure the services of a designer so as to ensure that my book is so aesthetically alluring that even someone with a reasonably serious sight impairment won't be able to flick through like you might normally in a bookshop or whatever. The arbitrary deadline I commit myself to for the completion of the maximisation of my book's visual appeal is September the 30th.
Okay. I think that's probably better, isn't it? That's what...
The deadline I commit myself to for the completion of the textual healing of my book is October the 15th, 2022. This is so that I can tap the lucrative Christmas market for Comedy Downstairs toilet books. This I swear unto you now, here before God, Sir David Attenborough, Claire Balding, John Dave, and Her Royal Highness the Queen, Your Majesty.
Your Majesty.
Else let the consequences be pernicious, far-reaching, and not in the least bit nice. Hither thus to hear for... this legalese. I'm getting stuck in the legalese here, John. Hither thus to hear for the consequence appertaining. I swear to sign up for daily investment advice emails from Nigel Farage's Fortune and... Is this real? Does he do this?
This is for real, yeah.
This is a thing.
That's what he does now.
I swear to sign up for daily investment advice emails from Nigel Farage's Fortune and Freedom financial newsletter. Will that get me put on a list or something somewhere?
Daily emails
from Nige.
Yeah. Bloody hell.
Which you might consider consequence enough. However, the cost of this service is 100... He charges for this! Which will be paid to Nigel in full in the event of the non-fulfillment of this promise. I don't know if that's a step too far, John. I think I can probably agree to the concept of it. I appreciate it, but that's
It might help though.
It might be that little push. It's the push that you need, Tom.
That's it. That'll help you stay on the straight and narrow. That'll force you to get this beautiful little book out there where it belongs.
Brilliant. Well, I look forward to buying that for someone else, obviously, at Christmas.
Get in. It's happening, guys.
Something's finally happening.
It's actually happening.
So, next week, we critique John's tree book, then, to make it only fair.
Well,
Well,
actually, no. I'm not doing anything with this book.
Until?
Unless at the end of this podcast, at the end, after it's finished, people can sit down and listen to John present his tree story.
Yes. That would then be... let me just check. I'm just hearing that would then make it actually legally binding.
The thing with that is...
What's good for the goose is good for the gander.
It sounds simple, doesn't it? That does sound simple.
Yeah.
But the slight problem with that is I've tried to record it several times. And I've just not found a convincing way of doing a tree. It reads really well, I think. It reads, it comes off the page just nicely. But once it goes into my mouth... Then.
I tell you what, just record the sound of you reading it, like silently to yourself. Chuckling.
That is the noise
chuckling
made,
away
to be fair.
At your own cleverness.
But how about this? How about I put this forward? I put the story on our blog.
Okay, but you have to read you have to read at least a bit of it, I think. How long is it?
It's 20,000. It's quite long. It's 20,000.
Oh, that's quite long.
It would take a long time to read. But it is also in parts, so I could read a part.
Well, read part one.
You've got a short part. Well, just pick what's the shortest part? Doesn't matter where it's from in the story, no one cares. Just the bit that people won't have to listen to for that long.
It's got to be the first part. Don't be silly.
Read the first part.
I think read the first part and then leave it with, you know, anticipation hanging in the air.
See, here's the thing as well.
Oh,
right.
My God, John.
This is the other thing. No, this is important because this book is like part of its... like entire reason for existence is that I'm planning to write a load of love stories and put them out as a little compendium of love stories, right?
Right.
And so I don't want to give too much away. Do you know what I mean?
No one's going to read it.
I think it's good marketing to get out of there, whet people's appetite, then maybe you'll get around to doing the rest of it. Do you mean like it's good... stimulus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you put it out there and people go, actually, that was bloody good. I'd read more of them.
Yeah.
Imagine that. Fire in your belly. Or alternatively, people go, fucking hell, wait that long for that. That was shit. And then you don't have to bother writing the other stuff.
Either way,
you're a winner.
You've got nothing to lose. Yeah. Absolutely.
The worst thing that could happen is you put it on there and people go, yeah, it was all right, actually. Yeah. Then you're in no man's land. You don't know what to do then. Mm.
Yeah.
Come on, this is the whole point of this endeavor was to get us to actually finish something and do something with it.
Well, the story is finished.
Damn it.
But yeah.
Well, there we go. Get it out there, John.
All right.
Tom.
Okay.
Come on.
All right.
We can do this.
You convinced me. I'll put out part one.
Right.
That's as much as you're getting for now.
Right.
All right.
Okay.
Okay.
Done.
Deal.
Christ, you don't think it would...
Dave, that just leaves you, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, I'm still waiting for you to finish reading my book, Tom.
Well, me and John have been on with that, Dave. And what we've actually done is sent your book away. You'll be receiving a full box of printed manuscripts, fully bound up. You've got your first book signing in Barnstable tomorrow.
Brilliant.
So you probably need to set off now because it's an early start, okay? Yeah, no, we haven't done anything for you, Dave. But in a few weeks' time, we will be...
going through all this all over again.
Having a chat about you.
Brilliant.
I feel like I need to reread it because I can't really remember. Yeah. I can't really remember it.
So there's John's
sign
review.
Sign of a good book, that, isn't it? Sign
of
a good book.
I've read it.
Hang around with you
can't
too
remember
long.
A single word.
No, I actually can. I'm kidding. Of course I can. I've got a great memory.
Yeah, it was the one with the army stuff and things in, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was the army. Oh, it was the army thing. That's it. Yeah. No, I do remember it. Of course I do. I did enjoy it, Dave. I did enjoy it.
Don't worry.
That's just a little precursor. I want to raise your hopes before I dash them.
Excellent. Brilliant.
So there you go. How exciting. We're moving forward, fellas.
Yeah. So what else have we got coming up then, chaps?
I'll tell you what we have got. A while ago, and we've probably forgotten about this, although it was very good, we did an interview with a chap called Nels Abbey.
I remember that.
Nels
interview.
Do
you remember that?
Yeah.
Remember that?
It was really good, wasn't it?
It was. So I thought we may as well get that done next week.
Yeah.
Nice.
And as I recall, he gives us some helpful tips for our ongoing quest to write a sitcom comedy drama.
That's true. Yeah.
So perhaps it would be good to rehear that advice so we can... get a bit of fire in our bellies again.
Nice. We definitely need to do that for the poker night thing. That's slipped away a little bit, hasn't it?
Yes, a little bit, hasn't it? Yes.
A little bit off the boil.
Well, yeah, but I look forward to that interview immensely.
Yeah, Tom. John, remind people what his book was, so if they've got an intervening gap in the week, they can maybe pick it up and have a leaf through it.
It is called Think Like a White Man.
Great synopsis. No, I think that covers it. People will...
You're welcome.
So, so everyone listening, I want you to have read that by this time next week. I think that's
the interesting
enough,
aspect of his book, actually, which we touch on very briefly, don't really talk about that much, is like my Chad Nadworthy book, he uses a puppet to write it, doesn't
he?
Yes. To deliver it.
He uses a pseudonym, Dr. Boulay Whitelaw III. Yeah, I think the subtitle is Conquering the World While Black, How to Conquer the World While Being Black. And it is very eye-opening. It's funny and eye-opening, and disturbing at the same time, I think.
So get it read, people, and join us here next week.
Beautiful.
Cheers, boys.
Cheers, fellas.
Lovely to speak to you. Right, get on with it then, Tom. John, you've got your tasks.
Crack on.
Cheerio.
All right, we're on it.
People can just sit back and look forward to the first chapter of John's book.
Right? Hello, I'm a tree. I think
I love you, other tree.
Can I touch your leaves?
Really nice.
Can I touch your leaves?
See, this is the problem.
Very sexy bark.
This is the problem, right? How do you do? How do you do a voice for a tree that doesn't sound like that?
It doesn't sound like
Noel Fielding's
I'm
Moon.
A little tree.
What did you go with for your tree voice then, John? What was it?
Well, I've tried loads of different things and it just doesn't really work because trees don't speak.
No, but I mean, lots of things don't speak, but they get given voices in.
Or if they do speak, they speak like that.
They not That's speak the like the wind whistling through their leaves.
Hello.
Well, I've tried all kinds
I'm
of
a
sound
tree.
Effects. Yeah.
I'm a sexy tree.
That's quite sexy, isn't it?
Isn't it?
I just did that. It just came out. But bloody hell, if I was another tree, that would give me wood.
Maybe whispery. Yeah, maybe that's the way to go. I don't know.
Yes.
I don't know.
You know, maybe that kind of whispery that Brian Blessed does in his in-between mouth bits. You know, he does his,
"Hey, Brian Blessed!"
But in between times, he has more of a,
"I'm talking like this, and it's all like the wind whispering through the
that
tree."
That does sound a little bit like someone trying to squeeze one out, though.
Maybe that's what trees... You've got to remember, maybe not squeezing one out, but trees are constantly drawing fluid
squeezing
up.
Squeezing one in.
Yeah, so maybe they'd be really...
sucking inwards.
They're always
maybe they talk like that. I don't know. I'm sucking up some water.
Can't wait.
Hello.
Hello.
Where's everybody gone?
The Ancient by John Rand. Narrated by John Rand and Katie Rand. Part 1.
They first came in the gloaming time, when we had drained all of the heat from the sky. We, drowsy and restful then, sensed their soft tread through our discarded. We felt the vibration of their crisp, hissing song through the world breath. Two of them, together, the upright, matching footbeats, echoing their warm sounds between them. We listened, memorizing their rhythms and their chemistry and their courting calls. Only alone they return now to the Redberry Ancient, out on the edge.
19th of November, 1938. Dear Alfred, Mother found out we met on Saturday. Aunt Agnes saw us cross the cow field together. Oh, how pleased she was to tell Mother. What a victory over her young sister, to see her niece sneaking around with a boy. The way she and Uncle Seth stood at the back door and watched as I got a dressing down. Ugh, I got a powerful talking to. But she didn't tell Father, so at least I didn't get a hiding. By the way, in case you're wondering, it was worth it. I would do it again happily, a zillion times over. The awful thing is, I'll be watched now. Mother says she won't let me out of her sight, so it might be a while before I can see you again. I'm sorry I forgot to give you your gloves back. Thank you for lending them. I'll keep them safe until I see you, I promise. My hands were so cold. Well, one of them was at least. Did you hear the new Duke Ellington song on the wireless? Goodness, I nearly fell over dancing in the bedroom. Dolly thought I'd gone quite mad, slinking around in my petticoat. I closed my eyes, and I imagined I was with you in a New York bar, thick with smoke and gin fumes, drunk on the music and the feel of your hand on my waist. But the forest is a close second. Sort of magical, didn't you think? Thank you for everything you showed me. What all the different trees are called and the strange insects. I won't remember them all, I'm afraid, but it's wonderful how much you know. And the slow worm, I've never even heard of them. a legless lizard, right there under the roots of a tree. Astonishing. Yours glowingly, Betty.
Soon, when the sky had rested and began to burn anew, and we awoke to drink the light, they were back, moving deep into our innermost refuge, where our eldest stand and listen and know our whole domain. They paused by the great seed giver, climbed up into her fork and cut into the flesh. We felt it shudder through us. Then in a twinkling they were gone, only the shallow scar of them remaining.
13th of April, 1939. Dear Betty, how wonderful to see you again. I can't begin to tell you how glad I am that you managed to sneak away with me again yesterday. You're becoming quite the Houdini, slipping out without them noticing. What a sterling idea to use that hole in the yew tree as a postbox. It's been such a tonic to receive your letters over the last 5 months. Snatching moments with you is one thing, but it's so good to have something I can read and reread when I'm at home, especially with this being such a strange time. I still worry about war, even though Mr. Chamberlain thinks Hitler is satisfied with Sudetenland. Thanks for looking after my gloves. I liked you having them. Every time I got cold hands this winter, I could think of you and how you might be wearing them. And I could imagine it was me warming up yours. There's something I didn't tell you, Betty, that I really meant to, and I hope you don't mind me saying now, in a letter, what I should have had the bravery to say to you in person, but it's funny, even in a letter I'm finding it rather difficult. My heart is going like the clappers. I love you, Betty Hargreaves. I love you more each time I see you. I love your letters and your beautiful, kind face and your hands and your laugh and the way you skip through the trees. Yesterday, I thought carving the giant beech like that would show you, but it's not the same as telling you, so there you are. I will put this letter in the yew tree and walk away, and then you'll know. At some point, you'll read this and know, and I won't ever be able to change it. It felt quite destructive doing that to the beach, but I hope it didn't mind. Let's meet there again soon. Send me a time and date and I'll be there in an instant. Love, Alfred.
They returned during the last grow. The sky heat had been good, but the underdrink had dried. Slower and quieter than before they came, but we knew them. They trod in the cool of our shade and the clean of our breath, meandering like the trickle run. Like creatures injured, they limped through us as we listened. When they reached the great seed giver, they climbed higher than ever into her broad limbs and held each other. We felt them rain the ground with offerings, tiny drops of gratitude.
15th of September, 1939. Dear Alfred, I didn't go to school today. I couldn't. Mother said I didn't have a temperature, but I felt quite lightheaded and my stomach heavy as lead. Whenever I think about it, about you in danger, I have to lie down. It's not that I'm not proud of you, and I suspect when I see you in that uniform, I will be faint for other reasons. But I can't help feeling like we've only just got to really know each other, and now they're taking you away. I wish you weren't a year older than me. I wish you could stay. I know I'm being selfish and I should be strong for your sake. And I know I shouldn't have blubbed like a baby on Saturday. And I'll probably go to hell. But I already miss you as though someone's just come and removed a vital organ. I used to laugh at those love stories, the romance novels I sometimes read, with the girls so faint with adoration and the boys so handsome and strong and daring and all the other ridiculous clichés those writers are prone to. But here I am, not laughing anymore. Please write to me whenever you can. I will see you by that tree soon. I will. I love you too, Alfred Dalton, with all my heart. Betty.
Nothing of the two for four cycles. We grew. We slept. We burst with life. We died back. And still they stayed away. Once, in the midst of shadow time, we felt the heavy tread of another. One that haunted sometimes when the sky was cold. He dragged behind him a stiff trunk of carrion, opened up the ground and delivered to us his burden, flesh for our roots to feast upon, reaching gratefully through the earth towards the decay. Then, one morning soon after, we felt the two return, just to the edge, to the red berry ancient, one, then the other.
3rd of March, 1944. Dear Betty, I've been home a week and a half, plucking up the courage to come and see you. Then I spotted you today. You were leaving the butcher's with your mum. I had to hold on to the railing by the memorial for a moment. It was like seeing a ghost, but a very familiar and lovely ghost. I nearly shouted out, but my voice was all glued up, and then you were gone. And anyway, it didn't feel right. Mum told me you'd been seeing Stanley Grimshaw. I remember him. Chief Inspector's son. He was your year at school, wasn't he? Handsome. A good rugby player, if I'm not mistaken. And from a good family. You'll do okay with him, Bet. As you know, I've been posted in Burma. But what you probably don't know is that we've had no leave for the past 2 years. I did touch ground in Blighty last April, but we only got as far as Portsmouth before they turned us around. Said things had taken a turn and they needed us in France as soon as possible. I won't describe how painful it was to be so close to you, only to be ripped away again. I've torn a picture of a you from my observer's book of trees and will post it through your letterbox later today. I'm hoping it might lead you to this letter. I just needed to tell you, I'm sorry, Betty. I'm so sorry for not writing more. I want you to know that I hate myself, and I don't blame you for seeing Stanley. You must have wondered why the letters stopped. We got correspondence so rarely. Being out there, it's difficult to think of home. It's painful, even harder to find words that have any meaning. So much has happened in the last 4 years. I've done things, Betty, I will never be able to explain, forget, or forgive myself for. I'm sorry. I'm just so sorry. I hope you can forgive me. Stay safe. Mum told me about the girl from Hanston who went missing last week and still hasn't turned up, so please be careful, especially walking at night. I will stay with Mum tonight, then return to the base tomorrow. I didn't come to upset you or cause a fuss. I wish you well, Betty Hargreaves. I know just how special you are and what great things you will do in the future. Yours, Alfred.
The disappearing began after life's great pulse beat 3 more times. There had been so few slaughtered here since the Great Purge. We were unprepared. Great ground shakers came to our boundary and began to take us indiscriminately. Old and young, tall and squat, and all those we are guardian to. The grubs, the bugs, the slugs, the crawlers, climbers, carpets and creepers, even the winged and furred, all cleared away, opened up wide to the eyes of the sky. Then, with our lines alive with conference, there came a commotion. We sensed his footbeats and felt his cries, and as quickly as death began, it ceased.
10th of July, 1946. Dear Alfred, it was a shock to see you today. That's an understatement. It was a white-hot bolt of lightning. I nearly didn't write this. I nearly went home and tried to forget. But then I had to. I had to write something down or I'd go mad. And who else could I tell? Perhaps you'll never read this. Perhaps it's better that way. But seeing your face was the loveliest, most terrible thing that could happen to me. Why did you come to see me, Alfred? How could you do that? And to give me a gift? It's not right. You must see that. But perhaps it's worse for you to see me like this. Although more likely you feel like you've had a narrow escape. Now you see me with this great fat stomach sticking out. There's still a trace of your scent on my sleeve. Oh, Alfred, Stanley just told me you punched the foreman of the New Hollington estate they're building over by Courton Edge. You said you were trying to stop them clearing the forest to make way for houses. Is it true? That's not far from the U. I didn't know they were building there until he told me. Stanley said the police are looking for you. He's quite determined they'll catch you. He even asked for my help to bring you in. The Harlingtons are an influential family, and he could be up for sergeant if they arrest you. Please, Alfred, you must leave. Can't you see? You must. I can't stand it. And to surprise me like that. What if someone had seen us? You could have been caught, for God's sake. I hope you're well. I really do. But you mustn't come again. And no more gifts. I've put it straight in the dustbin outside without opening it. Yours pleadingly, Betty. P.S. I confess I just retrieved the parcel. I couldn't resist. The greatest jazz session ever. Parker, Gillespie and Davis. I've never heard anything so wild. Stanley will hate it. So this is bebop. I love it, Alfred.
Only one came alone now. A shadow, lost and silent over soft moss, or shifting over crisp, dry, rustling drifts, or sneaking over sheaves of long, squeaking leaves, intimate, inquisitive. At first sleeping at the foot of the great seed-giver, wound in her knotty feet, sustained by our fruit and fauna, patrolling the borderlands, keeping away the great parasites.
29th of April, 1948. Dear Betty, this will be my 30th letter without reply. I wrapped them in a bag to stop them getting wet and happened to count them. I know now that you will never come for them, but it's something akin to talking to you, and since Mum died, it helps me pass the time. You would be amazed, Betty, how beautiful the forest is right now. The lichen alone, bright orange lobes, little grey-green fronds and tufts of light green hair, and the insects. Once you start looking, the trees are alive with them, clashing stag beetles and iridescent rose chafers and beetles that pretend to be wasps, moths that hide in plain sight on bark or advertise themselves with glorious fat yellow bodies and exquisite pink-tipped wings. There's a colony of red squirrels here too. I couldn't believe my eyes. Thought they were all gone. But there they are. Little introverted, tuft-eared comrades. I've been trying to get closer to them, feeding them nuts and acorns, but they're wary as anything. They remind me a little of you when I asked, "Do you dance, madam?" that day on the bus. The startled way your eyes widened and your head darted round as if I might be talking to someone else. Harlington's building company still want to tear down more of the forest. I can't understand how they're allowed to. Each and every one of those trees is home to hundreds, if not thousands, of living things. I've written to every person I can think of to object, but it's a losing battle. I need help. I found out there are people that fight this kind of thing, and I've been trying to contact them, but it's not easy when you don't have a postal address. In the meantime, I continue with my guerrilla tactics. They're getting wise to my nightly raids, but they can't keep an eye on everything all the time, and I'm determined they will not take our forest. I would tell you where I'm hiding, but I worry in case the police should get their hands on these letters and find me. Yours always, Alfred.
For five more cycles, we and the Upright One became each other's guardians. We bestowed food, water, shelter and haven, hid him from the hard feet and the sniffers that sometimes invaded, and in turn, he kept us safe. Then, like the soft cold that settles on our limbs in the quiet of the shadow time, one day he was there, and the next, he had melted away. We were drowsy then, but we still knew her quick, light padding.
Dear Alfred, I didn't wake up this morning expecting to write to you today, but then I saw the newspaper, and there you were. It's not a clear picture, but I knew it was you. Robin Hood fellow. I had no idea you'd been so close all this time. They say you've been living in the forest for the last 5 years. Can that really be true? Like a mischievous but philanthropic forest sprite, it says in the paper. you have single-handedly disrupted the clearing of the southeastern edge of the forest. You may not know this, but over the last few years, you've become somewhat of a mysterious local celebrity. And now so many people support what you're doing, the council have had to take notice. The article says they've just agreed to block the Harlingtons from any further development there. I cheered out loud when I read that. There have been moments when I thought I caught a glimpse of you, through a window, or at the end of a street, or outside the hospital when I had my appendix out. But I always thought I'd imagined it, or had projected your face onto someone else. Now I'm not so sure. After reading the article, I don't know what made me, but I took a walk down to the U with little Hazel and Alfie. Imagine, I mean, just try to picture my expression. When I saw what was down, deep in the hollow there, it was a while before I could speak. All this time, and I had no idea. I just don't know how I feel, Alfred. That's the thing. I'm excited and happy and scared and sad all at the same time. My hands are shaking and I can't sit still. I haven't read any of them yet. I can't bear to. But I suppose I will. I've never been very good at resistance, as you know. The article said you haven't been seen for a while. I hope you're okay. If you do ever read this, Alfred, I truly wish you all the best. Your friend always, Betty.
She would come often then with her saplings, the world breath ringing with their calls, lifting old dead fallen, showing them the nests of our tiny, industrious ones, and how they recycle our flesh back to ground food. Once she came alone to the great seed giver, climbed into her arms again to rest, touched the old scars there, watered the ground anew with salt dew. By the time the sky heat burned afresh, she would return almost every light run, exploring each footway. But we knew he was not there to find.